Hello and welcome to Health Matters on Channels Television. Thanks for staying with us. I am Mary Alale Yusuf. The global count of confirmed COVID-19 cases was over 102 million on Friday, January the 29th, 2021. More than 56 million people have recovered and the death toll is over 2.2 million. That's an average of 550,000 cases a day for the week. In Nigeria, there are more than 128,000 confirmed cases, over 102,000 recoveries, and 1,577 deaths. That's more than 10,000 cases in 1 week, and over 8,500 recoveries. Recovery rate is up to about 79.8%, and fatality rate is 1.23%. A good number of confirmed cases are being managed in the home-based care program, which is designed for milder cases. The Nigeria Center for Disease Control has published a patient's handbook for home-based care of COVID-19. Let's look at what this entails and how it might be helping the war against COVID-19. Joining me in our Abuja studio is a public health physician, CEO of Preston Associates for International Development, and co-chair of the Health Sector Reform Coalition of Nigeria, Dr. Nkem Ene. You are welcome to the program. Now, if you can hear me, can you tell us what is classified as a mild case? How do you classify a mild case of COVID-19?
So typically, so I can hear you.
How do you classify the main, a mild case?
Symptoms. Yeah. So in order to identify what a mild case would be, I would define what a severe case is. So a severe case or moderately severe case would be someone who could have chest pain. Usually there's a dry cough. There's a fever that's probably 38 degrees or above. And the person is extremely weak. So those are the classical symptoms of those that are severely affected by this virus. So if somebody has a mild or asymptomatic disease, it's likely that they will feel unwell, they may be weak, they may have a cough, but that may be as, in fact, the cough is likely to not be seen more than you would see any other cough. So it wouldn't necessarily debilitate them in any way. And then they obviously would have tested positive for the disease in a lab. So that is what we would, and their temperature would not be above 38 degrees centigrade. Usually it's about 37.5 or thereabout.
So essentially the person could be feeling quite normal, like you or me. So What is the minimum standard for home-based isolation? By that I mean, what should the house be like? What should the accommodations be like?
Okay, so home-based care is recommended for those who are either asymptomatic with absolutely no symptoms, but have tested positive in a lab, or those that have very mild symptoms, like we described earlier. So typically these people are under 60, so they're relatively younger, their bodies can recover faster, and also they have access to adequate isolation facilities. So, you know, if somebody is supposed to be isolating at home, it would make no sense if they're in a room with 12 people. So ideally, this person should have access to a room where this person can be cared for by themselves. And also the air that they breathe needs to be adequately saturated with oxygen. So those are the kind of parameters at home that you need to have. In addition to this, you need to have a caregiver that has been designated to help that individual. So if we're saying that the person needs to stay in a room, in a house, for a long period of time, in this case, it may be up to 14 days, somebody needs to be available to, for instance, provide food, help with the laundry, since this person is not really expected to move around the home. So that is the kind of a setup that you would have in home-based care. Of course, we would expect the recommendations by the NCDC that have to do with the use of protective gear to be complied with, so the use of masks for effective infection control, the use of gloves, and a face shield if necessary. They could even have a complete covering for the body if it is such that the care that they're rendering requires that.
So I'm assuming that this caregiver is a member of the family. So a member of the family would be required to wear a full bodysuit, gloves, masks.
I think it depends on the case. So for instance, it doesn't always have to be a member of the family. It could be if the person, for instance, lives in a home with, let's say, just two people, and the other person that's in the home is elderly. There could be that a healthcare provider could visit the home in order to assist. But then, of course, you would expect all the parameters to be complied with. So the idea of what you wear, whether you wear a full bodysuit or whether you just need to use a face shield along with a mask and gloves, will depend on the case. So, for instance, if the person is asymptomatic, it is likely that the person can actually clean up after themselves inside the room, can move around within the room by themselves. So there wouldn't be a need for much interaction. On the other hand, if the person is unable to move, so for instance, the person is elderly and has problems with mobility normally, not as a result of the infection, that caregiver would have to be a little bit more involved in the care of the person within that room. So obviously we'd expect them, particularly if they're having to deal with touching bodily fluids and things that probably could be carrying the virus, we expect them to protect themselves adequately. Would rather you overprotect than underprotect.
Okay. I'm aware that Lagos has quite an extensive home-based care system, but I don't know about other states. Is this home-based care operational everywhere, do you know?
The policy is for everywhere. The guidelines were provided because of the issue around the limitation on the number of health facilities that we have, the limitation on the number of healthcare workers that are skilled to do this, and also the fact that out of the many cases that have been diagnosed in labs, not many of them are severe. I mean, in terms of the proportion. So if you're really going to hospitalize everybody who tested positive, you run out of hospital bed space.
That's right.
It is practical. It's a very practical set of guidelines for the people themselves to get involved, for families to get involved, for parents to get involved in the care of people who don't necessarily need that much hands-on care or specialized care. But we know that having them roam around is putting other people at risk. So it's a good set of guidelines for the country. So it's not just Lagos. It really applies everywhere.
So somebody is in home-based care, and expects that after a while he'll be able to move about and, join the family and everything. When can you escalate this to isolation in a hospital? What should the caregiver be looking for?
Okay, so this caregiver is expected, and it could even be the patient themselves, kind of taking their temperature if they're taught to do so, and monitoring what's happening with their temperature. So if they were asymptomatic and had a normal body temperature, and that starts to spike, that is a flag. That is a flag that something is developing that may need the attention of a skilled health worker. The second thing that could happen is somebody who didn't have a cough all of a sudden starts developing a cough. So the caregiver or the patient themselves needs to be very observant about what is progressing. So it's important to continue to monitor all the vitals. If the person all of a sudden becomes unstable, has a fast heart rate, the fever spikes, they start to cough or they have difficulty breathing, that is an indication that this person may need hospitalized care. And it would be recommended that they move this person from the home to a facility where they could get that care.
What happens if, through some sort of mistake or something, other members of the family become infected? And, it's like the situation is getting out of hand. Maybe two or three other people have become infected. What then happens?
Unless it's a very large home, I don't see how they can all isolate. And it also depends on the symptomatology. So if other people get it and they are showing symptoms, they need to be hospitalized. If they get the disease and they're not showing symptoms, it's a very large home, you could still probably have people home isolate at home. But then you would need caregivers for each of those people, because you don't want, even though they're not, you know, they're infective, and, you know, they probably could be infective even though they're asymptomatic. You know, they should be treated as you would treat one person. So they would need to be in their own room, even though, you know, because one could be at one stage of the infection, maybe only having 3 more days to go before they finish isolating. And then if you put another person who has a disease in the room, you could, you know, we could be talking about reinfection all over again, and that complicates the picture. So the idea is, as much as possible, keep each person who is infected, you know, isolated, so that they don't, you know, in large homes, what they suggest is that you have these cohorts. So the idea is to keep people, as much as possible, away from the person who is infected. If it's a large family, you want people to be in these mini bubbles within the home. So the people that need to interact, like a mother and a very small baby, could form their own cohort. Then, you know, those who are elderly could form their own cohort. So you kind of have their own preventative care differently. So in a home that has more than one person, depending on the symptomatology, those who are showing symptoms need to be moved immediately to a facility, and those who are asymptomatic need to be isolated so that they don't create any additional problems.
You know, a lot is said about washing of hands. A lot is said about physical distance and wearing of masks and other protective gear. But I don't hear a lot about cleaning of surfaces. What's the place of cleaning surfaces in all of this?
Okay. So the thing is that the virus, when people who are infected cough, or when they sneeze, or even talking, the virus is captured in respiratory droplets. So what could happen is people, I'm holding a book, I'm holding like a tablet, for instance, at work, and I could sneeze over that tablet and leave that tablet on a table. If somebody else comes along and uses that same chair that I was sitting in and touches my tablet, they have the chance of picking up the virus from what I was holding. So the point of, you know, occasionally sterilizing with a spray-based, with an alcohol-based kind of spray on surfaces and doing that often, is that there are things that people touch all the time. So, for instance, balustrades, people coming downstairs, you know, would typically run their hand along the railing as they come down. Oh, door yes. handles are always touched by people as they go into a room, that they have to do because there's no other way to open the door. So you could have a designated person, whether it's within the home or whether it's at the workplace, whose job it is to every so often, in my office, it's every 2 hours. Somebody goes around the building, cleans down desks, cleans down door handles and the railings in the building to ensure that, you know, we kind of break the cycle of people touching things and other people coming after them to touch and become infected as a result.
Okay, I've heard of people being in an isolation center, and then they say they downgrade them to home-based care. Why do they do that? Why don't they just discharge them, you know?
So the idea is to, particularly with isolation centers where the beds are rare, I mean, the beds are in high demand. The idea is you can step down the level of care without the person necessarily leaving care. So care will continue to be given, but at some point it's no longer as intensive as it once was. So the use of a respirator or a ventilator is no longer required. The temperature has probably gone down to a manageable range. So the person can continue to come. It could be that they're still weak. It could be that, you know, they still need some time to get back to who they were before they got infected. So for that, instead of doing that in a hospital bed, the idea is to make those beds available for people who have more severe symptoms, and this person can now continue to recover at home. But we know that while, you know, the incubation period may not have completely finished, and we know that person has the potential to infect someone. That's why we say that the person still has to isolate. But because they no longer need specialized care, they can do that at home under the, you know, the watchful eye of a designated caregiver.
Thank you so much, Doctor. We are going on a short break. When we come back, we continue with home-based care. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Health Matters on Channels Television, and we're talking about home-based care by the NCDC. You can call 0808-054-2233. It's on the screen. If you have any questions about home-based care, you can also tweet at CTV_MaryA. Now, Dr. Ene, people inhale all sorts of things, drink all sorts of things, rub all sorts of things, all in the name of keeping healthy and helping themselves. But what medications really are allowed in home-based care?
Okay, so I agree with you that a lot of people are trying to self-medicate with all sorts of things. But in home-based care, what is recommended is really nothing. The idea and the reason behind that is if you're the right candidate for home-based care, you really should not, if you don't have symptoms, we're not going to necessarily say that you need to take a particular medication. So the idea is just stay hydrated, you have to rest. You have to probably do some light exercise. Make sure that your room is well ventilated. And, you know, generally allow the body to recover. So it's not about, if you need specific medication, you really should be under the care of a physician. If you're taking other medications before you even got the COVID-19 infection, then you need to have the advice of your personal physician in terms of how those medications will be taken while you out self-isolate. But for the home-based isolation itself, no specific medication is recommended. What we're saying is that you need to be hydrated to ensure that your body does not, you know, that your fever doesn't start to spike. If you stay hydrated, you're less likely to have the dry cough develop. Mm-hmm. If you stay hydrated, you're likely to remain cool. So all those things, it's in your best interest to drink as much as you can, to stay well ventilated, like we said, in a room that, you know, natural air that is flowing across as opposed to air conditioning, if possible. Just isolate safely and make sure your diet is healthy and that you're eating, you know, lots of vegetables and all those things that are good for you, and that you're resting adequately and trying to exercise. Not rigorously, just enough to, you know, remain vital, so to speak.
Okay, this exercise. What if it's a person who doesn't exercise anyway? Are you going to ask the person to start because he has COVID?
Okay, that's a good question. I think the idea is really just not to, what we're not trying to do. We're not trying to have that isolation become a problem in itself, because it's possible for this person to lie on a bed for 14 days. That in itself is a problem. So what we're trying to say with that advice about light exercise is really just to keep the heart pumping, to not allow sputum, for instance, to accumulate in some part of the lungs. You want to keep your airways clear. You want to make sure that your circulation is pumping adequately. So you could just be walking around the room. It could just be changing positions, you know, regularly for somebody who doesn't do any exercise at all. For those who were exercising before they got infected, they can do a little bit more, jog in place. I mean, it really depends on how well the person is feeling. If the person is truly asymptomatic, then they should be able to do some level of exercise.
Okay, let's quickly take this.
Circulation and breathing are not affected.
Okay, then. Let's take this call from David. David is calling from Ikorodu. Hello, David.
Hello, good afternoon.
Afternoon, what's your question?
Yes. I really appreciate your efforts, and most of the numbers you are flashing in the screen are not going for this COVID-19 response desk. You know, I did a test in Ikorodu, but the test, that's Thursday back. So I have not been able to get the results. So what's the problem?
Hey, let's ask the doctor. Maybe she'll have an answer for us.
Well, I'm assuming this is a public facility that is under the auspices of probably either the Lagos State Ministry of Health or an NCDC facility that is based in Lagos State. So that's really an administrative question. Ideally, you're supposed to be contacted if it's positive. And even if it's negative, you're supposed to get your results back. At the time that you were registering for the test, they must have collected contact details from you. And there's a certain number of days that they'll tell you within which to expect your result. Typically, those who are test positive get their results faster. And those who test negative, you know, that's more of a routine administrative update. So if you haven't heard anything, while it is not necessarily a good thing that you haven't heard anything yet, but if you haven't heard anything, it's more likely that you have a negative result, hopefully.
Okay, we spoke about if a person's temperature spikes, the physician has to come into the picture and all that. But for a normal home-based patient who isn't having any problems at all, how much physician involvement is supposed to take place in that home-based care?
Well, the idea is that it shouldn't necessarily need physician involvement. The guidelines for home-based care are issued by have been issued by the NCDC. I know that some states, they have these case management like boards within each, or teams within each state, that may have state-specific guidelines to add to the home-based care setup. But typically, the perfect candidate for home-based care should not need physician intervention for the 14 days that they'll be in isolation. That's the max number of days that they would need to be by themselves. So it's set up in such a way that the ideal candidate who is eligible does not require a physician to be present. If they did, it would be more efficient for the physician to see them in a hospital setting.
Let's take this call from Wilson, and then we'll get back to, there's something I need to ask you. Hello, Wilson. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm good.
What's your question?
Yeah. I think, first of all, thank you for this program. I want to ask the doctor, of recent, I noticed that my breath is bad. I don't really know exactly how to go about it. What could be the actual cause? And secondly, it has gotten to a point whereby if I sweat, due to the nature of my work, it looks as if that the odor is coming out through my sweat. I don't really know. Because I said this because when I now let her pull off my innerwear and smell it, I discovered that I don't really know how to explain it. So what could be the problem, or is there anywhere?
Did you say your breath is labored? Difficulty?
Yes. No, I said my breath is bad. It's bad. Smelly.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Wilson. Well, doctor, I don't think that's COVID, but you tell us.
No. No, it sounds like a condition called, if it's breath that is bad, I'm assuming what he means by that is that it smells bad, in which case that would be halitosis. And there are quite a few causes for halitosis, but I would suggest that he goes to see his personal physician to have some test run to be sure that we get to the root cause of why his breath is smelling bad. As for the sweating, if you're doing a strenuous job, you're expected to sweat, and sweat does have smell if it's allowed to dry on you. So that in itself may not be, pathological. It could just be that that's the nature of the work that he does. But for the halitosis, I would definitely advise him to seek the care of a physician that can, you know, run some tests and do a more thorough workup for him.
All right. Thank you so much, doctor, for those answers and for all the education. We've come to the end of the program. Thank you so much for being with us. And thanks for your calls, David and Wilson. Have a wonderful day. I am Mary Alala Yusuf.